the whole thing was about underground economy, offshore banking, and money laundering offshore by everybody from Noriega to the Russians and everything. And everybody's implicated, real life people. Of course, I changed names and stuff, but so I was really nervous about releasing it. I'm like, oh, what if, people get mad at me or whatever. So it was like October 2015, and then literally months later, two or a few months later, the Panama Papers came out. So my story was mainstream by then. And so that was the first big weird coincidence.
On that note, Lorraine Ivanoff, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Politics or Pedagogy.
You're very welcome.
This is John Crumshaw with a special Politics or Pedagogy Education Report.
On KPFK, you hear more than a soundbite. That's education. That's our mission.
Please make your contribution at 818-985-5735 or pledge online at kpfk.org.
90.7 KPFK, Los Angeles.
Good afternoon and welcome to Middle East in Focus. I'm Negwa Ibrahim. The death toll from Israel's genocide in Gaza has climbed to over 63,300 since October 7, 2023, with an additional over 159,800 Palestinians wounded. UNICEF spokesperson Tess Ingram has publicly stated that Gaza has become, quote, the most dangerous place in the world for children, end quote, warning that the territory has transformed into a place where their lives are being destroyed. Ingram noted that that a Palestinian child is killed or wounded every 10 minutes, stressing that the only way to end the killing and maiming of children is a ceasefire. And on Thursday, Palestine's leading human rights group presented further evidence of genocide in Gaza, accusing Israel of seeking to annihilate Palestinians in the enclave. In a 204-page report titled Voices of the Genocide, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights concluded that Israel has committed four of the five acts prohibited under the 1948 Genocide Convention with the intent to destroy Palestinians in Gaza as a group. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights has previously labeled Israel's conduct in Gaza as a genocide, but Thursday's report is the culmination of the organization's documentation of genocidal evidence over the past 22 months. The report comes a week after the UN's Starvation Monitor declared that an Israeli-imposed famine has taken place in Gaza as a result of the siege and the ban on humanitarian aid. The Palestinian Center for Human Rights report echoes conclusions by leading human rights organizations that have investigated Israel's campaign in Gaza since October 2023. In December 2024, Amnesty International concluded that Israel had committed genocide during its war on Gaza, while Human Rights Watch concluded that genocidal acts had been committed. Francesca Albanese, a jurist and the UN Special Rapporteur on Palestine, authored two reports last year suggesting that genocide was taking place in Gaza. Most recently, two major Israeli rights groups, B'Tselem and Physicians for Human Rights Israel, released reports in July 2025 accusing Benjamin Netanyahu's government of genocidal acts and incitement. Additionally, Israeli genocide historian Omer Bartov in July 2025 wrote, quote, "My inescapable conclusion has become that Israel is committing genocide against the Palestinian people. I have been teaching classes on genocide for a quarter of a century. I can recognize one when I see one," end quote. "Ongoing denial of the genocide," he added, "will, quote, cause unmitigated damage not just to the people of Gaza and Israel, but also to the system of international law established in the wake of the horrors of the Holocaust, designed to prevent such atrocities from happening ever again," end quote. In fact, Bartov observes, "There is now an overwhelming consensus among genocide scholars who study comparative genocide or different genocides worldwide that what we are witnessing in Gaza is indeed a genocide." And while many are condemning Israel's genocide in Gaza, in July 2025, the Massachusetts Legislature's Judiciary Committee heard testimony on a bill to make it the 38th state to follow the federal government, 45 other countries, and more than 50 U.S. local governments in adopting a definition of anti-Semitism that is being used to help criminalize opposition to genocide. As Avi Chomsky lays out in her most recent piece entitled The Nightmare in Gaza, Preventing Criticism in Israel by defining it as anti-Semitic, states a definition of anti-Semitism is being adopted within laws and policies throughout the United States and Europe that is in fact weaponizing anti-Semitism as a shield to enable genocide. So today, we are talking about how laws and policies throughout the United States is adopting the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's working definition of anti-Semitism, which criminalizes opposition to genocide and actually weaponizes anti-Semitism as a shield to enable genocide, with our guest, Avi Chomsky, professor of history and coordinator of Latin American studies at Salem State University in Massachusetts. Her most recent book is Science Enough, 40 Critical Questions About Climate Justice. And her recent article is entitled The Nightmare in Gaza, Preventing Criticism in Israel by Defining It as Anti-Semitic. Welcome, Avi Chomsky, to Middle East in Focus.
Thank you for having me on. It's great to be here.
So we're going to dive right in because there is a lot to talk about. I really, really appreciate your most recent piece. Could you provide us some context about who the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, who they are specifically, when and why was it created, who runs the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, and who are its members?
So the IHRA, which I'll call it for short, the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, was created in the late 1990s. It's a consortium initially of mostly European governments and also joined by some of the US, Australia, Canada, Israel, non-European, European descendants, countries. But basically in the context of European Holocaust studies and European cultural and political ways of trying to engage with the Holocaust that occurred in Europe. And your listeners may know that in a number of European countries, Holocaust denial is actually a punishable crime. And the concept of freedom of speech that we have in the United States, that no matter how offensive or false your position may be, you still have the right to speak it, that doesn't really exist in the European context. So so that's sort of the context in which it was created by a European governments who contracted a scholar, Kenneth Stern, to work with them. And he was then working for the a major Jewish organization, I think the GCC, Combined Jewish Philanthropies, one of the big Jewish organizations in the United States, to write a working definition to monitor and study anti-Semitism in Europe. So it was very clearly stated that it was not a legally binding definition. It was a definition to help European governments monitor and evaluate what was going on in their societies in terms of anti-Semitism. And the definition itself is relatively uncontroversial, but what makes this definition extremely controversial is the examples of anti-Semitism that it gives. And again, this was never intended to restrict freedom of speech in the United States. It was never intended to be legally binding. It was never intended to be part of university speech codes. It was intended to facilitate data collection. But it has increasingly been adopted, as I mentioned in the article that you just quoted, by governments as a legal definition, including the U.S. government under the first Trump administration, and many states in the United States. and is now being enforced in universities as part of a speech code that actually makes it illegal to do the things, the examples that it lists. And why the examples are so controversial is that most of the examples don't actually have anything to do with anti-Semitism. What they say is that it's prohibited to criticize Israel in different ways. And there are 11 examples, 7 of them relate to criticism of Israel. So this is why I make the argument in the article that accusing Israel of genocide is outlawed under this definition of anti-Semitism, because accusing Israel of genocide is listed as one of the, or incorporated in one of the examples of anti-Semitism.
And I want to unpack even in more detail these examples and the definition laid out by the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, IHRA. Before we get there in more detail, I wanted, and maybe you already said this, who runs the IHRA?
It's a consortium of European governments.
I see. Okay.
So it's an intergovernmental organization.
Got it. And the United States has no role within the IHRA?
No, the United States has also joined it. So that's why I said European countries, and then there's a bunch of European offspring. The United States, Canada, Australia are part of it. There's 35 countries that form it now.
Okay.
Israel is also part of it. I think there's one Latin American country, Argentina, that has joined it. But it's basically an intergovernmental organization.
Got it. Sorry.
Primarily European.
Got it. Thank you so much. Sorry, I missed that. Okay, so now can you explain, before we get into the specifics around the definition, what prompted the IHRA to develop this working definition of anti-Semitism specifically in 2016?
Well, the definition had actually been around before that, and it was elaborated, but it was officially adopted in 2016 in the United States. It was President Trump in 2018, I believe, by executive order, announced that the United States was also adopting it.
Go ahead.
I guess I need to say it's a combination of the sort of larger context that I was describing earlier in terms of European grappling with the history of the Holocaust and trying to understand the status of Jews in Europe today and anti-Semitism in Europe today, and the lack in Europe of the same kind of guarantees of freedom of speech that we have here, so that the criminalization of speech is more accepted in Europe than it is generally in the United States. And the real push in the United States to have it adopted not as a working definition, which is what the IHRA called it, but as a legal definition, is coming primarily from right-wing Zionist organizations, specifically in the context of trying to insulate Israel from any responsibility for crimes that it commits, because basically accusing Israel of doing or even stating the facts about what Israel is doing. And you hear Netanyahu every single day, every time somebody mentions what Israel is doing, he says that's blood libel. And blood libel is one of the things that the IHR definition gives an example of anti-Semitism. So the concept of blood libel comes from deeply historical anti-Semitism, accusing Jews of killing Christian children and using their blood for rituals. But it's the concept of blood libel has been expanded to any accusation that Israel kills people. So you can't even say that Israel kills people, because that gets called blood libel.
So and we're definitely going to get further into that before we actually go there. So just so again, I'm clear. So the definition was established before 2016, but started becoming more widely adopted 2016 and beyond. And as you pointed out, in our discussion that while the definition is relatively straightforward, the real problems within it are the examples used to explain how to apply the definition, and that's where you really see the problems with it. And one of the things you actually state in your piece specifically is that IHRA's definition of antisemitism, quote, appears relatively straightforward, even if it focuses on thought and speech rather than structures of racism. Can you explain what you mean by this and the significance of the definition's focus on thought and speech, and elaborate on this, as I know you've been already talking about it, rather than structures of racism, and why that's important to understand?
Yeah, let me just read you the definition that was adopted in 2016 by the IHRA. It's really short. Antisemitism is a certain perception of Jews, which may be expressed as hatred toward Jews. Rhetorical and physical manifestations of antisemitism are directed toward Jewish or non-Jewish individuals and or their property, towards Jewish community institutions and religious facilities. So there's really two different ways in the academy and in politics that racism is thought about. One is to define racism as an individual bias, prejudice, or sentiment, that racism resides in the hearts of individuals. And that's sort of the maybe the most centrist or liberal or right-wing definition of racism, to sort of narrow it to ideas held by individuals. The deeper way that people look at racism is to see racism as embedded in institutions, systems, and structures. So instead of interrogating whether an individual has racist sentiments, scholars of racism look at how things like housing policy, sundown towns, segregation, slavery, big institutional factors. They look at health statistics, lifespan, education, all kinds of structural systemic things to see how does racism work in society. And of course, those two, like individual attitudes and prejudices and systems of laws that discriminate, policies that discriminate, those two can go together. But what's interesting, that is, most anti-racist organizations in the United States that have been formed to fight against racism have focused on trying to dismantle the structures of racism. But this definition of anti-Semitism and the Jewish organizations focus solely on feelings of racism, racist speech. And the reason for that is that while if we go back to the early 20th century, Jews, like other European immigrants of the time, say Irish, Italians, Poles, there was widespread structural discrimination against recent European immigrants in the late 19th and early 20th century. And certainly that was manifested against Jews as well. Over the course of the 20th century, those forms of structural and ideological emotional, psychological hatred of 19th and early 20th century European immigrants have mostly faded into the background. That doesn't mean that they have vanished entirely. You can still hear anti-Irish jokes and anti-Jewish jokes, and those things still exist. There's still some sort of bastions of WASP social life where non-WASPs are considered like wannabes and don't belong, you know, kind of this blue blood Boston thing definitely still exists. But overwhelmingly, structural racism is faced by people of color in the United States, not by ethnically defined European immigrants, including Jews. So that Native Americans, African Americans, Black immigrants, Latinos, anti-immigrant racism. There's all kinds of, especially right now, anti-immigrant racism, where it's completely legitimized and justified to just grab people off the streets and throw them into jail because they're immigrants, or deport them all over the world. So those are the more structural forms of racism that immigrant rights organizations or Native American rights organizations are mostly are aimed at fighting against. And they're less interested in trying to, well, of course, there's some scholars who focus on trying to define, okay, so how does the psychological form of this racism work? It's not that that's an irrelevant idea, but it's not the main focus. Whereas for the Jewish organizations, it's the main focus.
And I think to the point you make in your piece and that you've been making in this conversation is it's focused on feelings or feelings of racism or prejudice and feelings of quote unquote racist and also racist speech, but specifically defining anti-Semitic feelings or anti-Semitic speech as any criticism of Israel. And that is the problem in the definition, which you sort of lay out again in your work. Can you explain why IHRA's definition of anti-Semitism actually makes it impossible to know whether, in fact, it is true and accurate that anti-Semitism is on the rise in this country? Because one of the things, again, and just to give a little bit more context around this question, one of the things you point out in your piece and that we've just been talking about is that, you know, IHRA's definition of anti-Semitism is non-legally binding, but there have been advocates over the years that have been pushing for the legal adoption of IHRA's definition, claiming that it's necessary because anti-Semitism is on the rise in this country. But again, as you importantly point out, the way it's defining anti-Semitism and anti-Semitic speech and feelings is based on any criticism against Israel. So now, with that context, now can you explain why IHRA's definition of anti-Semitism actually makes it impossible to know whether, in fact, it is true and accurate that anti-Semitism is on the rise in this country?
Well, so the question is, what are we measuring? And if we use the IRA definition, every Palestinian rights demonstration that has a sign in it that says, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, is counted as an example of anti-Semitism. Any scholarly article that talks about, that acknowledges the fact that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza is counted as an example of anti-Semitism. So what is real anti-Semitism? I'm not sure that we can, that there's any way to count people's feelings, but anti-Semitic acts, like, say, you know, drawing swastikas on a synagogue or something that that would fit an example of anti-Semitism, of hatred of Jews as Jews, that would actually fit the definition rather than the examples, we don't know if those are increasing or not, because clearly, since the Israeli invasion of Gaza, there has been a lot of protest against what Israel is doing and a lot of discussion about what Israel is doing. And organizations like the Anti-Defamation League simply count those up and say all of these things show rising anti-Semitism. And even some acts of violence, like, say, the shootings in Washington, D.C. or in Boulder, Colorado, that are clearly acts of political violence aimed at representatives of Israel and Israeli policy. Those are acts of political violence. And I'm not sure we can judge whether there was anti-Semitism involved in those attacks or not. And I think it's kind of interesting to compare the shooting of the United Health CEO, which was also an act of political violence. Even among many people who do not engage in or support political violence in this country, had a kind of a feeling of, and there was a lot of news coverage of, like, wow, that resonated with a lot of people because a lot of people are really angry at insurance companies. But we never saw that kind of analysis after the DC shooting or the Boulder shootings. Like maybe that resonated with some people because people are really angry about what Israel is doing.
This is Middle East in Focus, and we are talking about how laws and policies throughout the United States is adopting the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance's working definition of anti-Semitism, which criminalizes opposition to genocide and actually weaponizes anti-Semitism as a shield to enable genocide, with our guest, Avi Chomsky, professor of history and coordinator of Latin American studies at Salem State University in Massachusetts. Her most recent book is Science Enough? 40 Critical Questions About Climate Justice, and her recent article is entitled The Nightmare in Gaza, Preventing Criticism in Israel by Defining It as Anti-Semitic. Avi, can you talk about how, although the IHRA's definition of anti-Semitism, as we've been speaking about, is non-legally binding, it is in fact becoming legally binding because laws and policies throughout the United States and Europe are actually adopting this definition, and why adopting this definition is actually dangerously weaponizing anti-Semitism as a shield to enable genocide?
So, I mean, the definition was written to be non-legally binding, and the countries that adopt as part of their Budapest Convention of this group of countries, call it a non-legally binding definition. But once a government adopts it, it becomes legally binding. So I think we need to distinguish the purpose of the definition as it was written to be non-legally binding, and the fact that it is being written into law. In that case, it becomes legally binding. And I do just want to clarify that it doesn't prohibit any criticism of Israel, but it prohibits what it calls blood libel. So it prohibits accusing Israel of killing people. It prohibits comparing Israel to the Nazis. So it prohibits using the term genocide with respect to what Israel is doing, or describing what Israel is doing, whether or not you use the word genocide. It prohibits criticism of the concept of a Jewish ethno-state, saying that it calls that denying Jewish self-determination. And so it prohibits criticism of Zionism as a political project and the state of Israel as a racist ethno-state. So that is prohibited. So not all criticism of Israel is prohibited. I want to be clear about that. But criticism of what Israel is doing in Gaza is all basically falls under that definition. And it sets people up to be fired from universities, to be denied employment, and to be criminally prosecuted for engaging in for simply describing what is happening in the world. And this is why Rashid Khalidi said he cannot teach his Middle East history class anymore. In an article in The Guardian, he said, I cannot get up in front of a class and talk honestly about what has happened in the Middle East because I will be subject to prosecution by my university.
You know, Avi, we have just about a minute left. If you could just end on this. Why is it important to understand that such a definition, like the IHRA's definition and what has now been adopted into laws within the United States as well as in Europe, actually has nothing to do with anti-Semitism, and why you felt it important to write this article?
I felt it important to write the article because I feel like there's a large swath of liberal thought in my own university, in all universities in the United States, that knows nothing really about what's going on in Israel and Palestine and what Israel is doing right now and has